This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
Good evening. My name is Sina Najafi. I'm editor-in-chief of Cabinet Magazine, and I'm thrilled that you could join us tonight for this event, Lives in the Margins, featuring two illustrious scholars, Anthony Grafton and William Sherman, both of whom I'm very happy to say have contributed to the magazine as well. If the study of marginalia has moved from the margins into some kind of center and has been at the forefront of a kind of interdisciplinary study of reading, these two scholars have been an instrumental part of that. And Bill, emailing me about this event, said, "We've calculated between the two of us, we've spent circa 60 years studying the margins of texts and thinking about the margins in our own books as well." So I'm very happy that they could join us here tonight. Anthony Grafton, is professor of history at Princeton University, where he's been chair of humanities and director of the Shelby Cullum Davis Center for Historical Studies. His books are many. I'll just mention a few. Joseph Scaliger, The Footnote, and The Culture of Correction in Renaissance Europe. He's currently working with Joanna Weinberg on a study of a Christian reader of Jewish texts, Johann Buxtorf, and preparing the 2014 Mellon Lectures, provisionally entitled Past Belief, Renaissance Visions of Early Christianity. William Sherman is professor of English at the University of York in the UK, where he was founding director of the Center for Renaissance and Early Modern Studies. He's the author of Used Books, Marking Readers in Renaissance England, and is currently working on a study of visual marginalia called The Reader's Eye. His exhibition on the birth of cryptography, which is something that he had written about for an issue of Cabinet, Decoding the Renaissance, opens at the Folger Shakespeare Library in Washington in November 2014. I'm going to hand over to them. We will have their presentation, and then there'll be a Q&A afterwards as well. So please join me in welcoming Tony and Bill.
Wow. Thank you very much, Sina, and thank you all for coming. What an amazing turnout at such short notice. I'll try to compete with this pipe here, but hopefully it'll settle itself down. Basically, a couple of months ago, Tony and I were at a conference on marginalia in Baltimore, on digitizing marginalia, and we were in the margins of a street, walking in the margins of a conversation about marginalia with our third partner, really, the silent partner tonight, who's Lisa Jardine, who's the person who brought us together. And we realized that together we had actually spent well over 100 years looking at marginalia, the three of us, them more than me, actually. So, and we thought, you know, we started to talk about how we got into the topic and what had changed in the long period, and the fact that it is weird, this really quirky practice has been so central and so generative and so fruitful for us for a really long time now. But we hadn't really told the stories of how we got interested in it, how the field and how our lives in the margins developed. And so we thought it was a really good moment to start doing what in effect is a sort of oral history of our work in and on the margins. And we thought this would be the perfect setting. I think it really is a sort of a suitably marginal and quirky setting. But also a live dialogue in front of a lot of people. Because one of the things that marginalia teaches us, as you'll see, and as most of you probably know, is that while reading is often considered one of our most private activities, books are profoundly social things. And I think that's the thing that we keep getting struck by and brought together over. And so it feels very appropriate to be coming back together with Tony, who I think I met more or less in front of a marginal book, marginal annotations, and we're still here. So this is a story about people coming together in the margins of old books then and now, and even though it's a sort of history of the history of reading, it might as well be called not reading. So I think we should go to that.
Actually, let's. This was how Paul Gauguin put the question we're asking tonight. So, welcome and thanks everybody for coming. This is just wonderful. So, the first time when I realized I was thinking about marginalia, which was not the first time I studied marginalia, was in around 1980. My wonderful colleague Robert Darnton had published the year before this extraordinary book, The Business of Enlightenment, on the printing of the quarto version of Diderot's Encyclopedia, a revelatory book, part of an enterprise to bring the history of publishing, the history of the actual marketing and reception of books into a fruitful marriage with intellectual history, the book in which Bob was able to identify the workman who had left his inky thumbprint in a particular copy of the Encyclopedia, just a magical book. Bob was doing wonderful revisionist work, mau-mauing Peter Gay, mau-mauing the French, showing how this work was to be done. And he was beginning to talk about another aspect of things, more in the realm of consumption than production, and that's to say the history of reading. He was starting to wonder if it would ever be possible to historicize reading, to get into the head of a reader. And as it happened, I had published an inconceivably boring article, a piece of hyper-pedantry, of which I remain very proud. It was a study of how Joseph Scaliger, the great scholar to whom I've dedicated much of my life, had read a book on papyrus by a German scholar named Wieland, and how he had been very irked by this book and filled its margins with reading comments, which, because he was a 16th century humanist, were cast in rather elaborate Latin phrases and Greek quotations, my favorite being when this guy quoted an equally unrespectable source, Scaliger says in Greek, "Ah, the pot has found its lid," a phrase which I've found useful on many occasions since. So here was an actual record of reading, which Scaliger then worked up later into a full-scale blast against this guy's book. So I gave a copy of this inconceivably boring article to Bob, who, in his kindness, took it away and read it and came back and said, "That's not reading. That's something else. This is rhetorical. It's elaborated. That isn't the history of reading." And I said, "Okay." And stopped pursuing this line at the moment. Though this will all come back, and the cast of characters will reassemble in very different form later on. One of the things this illustrates, perhaps the main thing, is contingency. And one of the burdens of our talk tonight, I think for both of us, is going to be the extraordinary role, very difficult to detect when you approach things as a historian of science, full of ideas about power and models of explanation and senses of how things work, the sheer raw role of contingency, even in a very developed Wissenschaft like intellectual history in the 20th and 21st centuries, is hard to keep an eye on. That's one of the things we'll be looking at. Now, in fact, I can tell you exactly when I got into margins. It was 1974, and I was trying to understand this. This ugly thing is the list of Egyptian dynasties compiled around 300 BCE by an Egyptian priest named Manetho. It is the real list of Egyptian dynasties. You can find it in Egyptian in Turin in the so-called royal canon on the wall of the Great Turin Museum. Joseph Scaliger discovered it, translated into Greek in a manuscript, and in 1606 he printed it. This was the kind of thing he was paid for. He had been hired at the most thrusting and innovative university in Europe, the University of Leiden, where they paid him more than the lawyers and didn't ask him to do any teaching, to do chronology, the history of things like Egyptian dynasties. So, wahoo, here is the real list of Egyptian dynasties. There was only one fly in the ointment, but it was big and it buzzed very loudly. The problem was that this is a world in which history begins with the creation, as recorded in the book of Genesis, taking place, depending on which text of Genesis you accept, around 4000 BCE or around 5200 BCE. And these dynasties start not just before Noah's flood, they actually start before the creation of the world. So that's kind of ugly. And Scaliger looks at this and tries to here give a long note saying, well, you know, sort of mathematicians and astronomers assume these proliptic periods. They just sort of, so this is proliptic history. We're just going to sort of pretend that the history happened before there was any time or any sun and moon to make time. We're just going to call this sort of extra history. So I tried to understand this. Both the dynasties and Scaliger's explanation were the casus belli for generations of ferocious argument about chronology. They eventually were one of the elements that helped to loosen the hold of the Bible on chronology a couple of generations later. But what I wanted to know was this a plausible argument by the standards of the time? And I found it really hard to know if this argument was plausible or not, because I found people who denied it and people who accepted it, but I couldn't really tell why any of them was a privileged observer. Now, I did know about one person whose opinion I would have liked to have. The man Scaliger respected most in the contemporary world was Isaac Casaubon, whom he himself said is the greatest Greek scholar in the world. Je lui cède. I acknowledge his superiority. Casaubon, of course, is now remembered because he gave his name to the horrible anti-hero of George Eliot's Middlemarch. The second time I read Middlemarch, I was in Jerusalem, and I remember running down the hall of the Institute for Advanced Study in Jerusalem, banging on the door of Natalie Zeman Davis and saying, Natalie, I'm older than Mr. Casaubon. To which she replied, it's all right. If you had been Mr. Casaubon, Dorothea would have been happily married. That's the nicest thing anyone's ever said to me. So the real Mr. Casaubon was an incredible scholar, and this much I knew. He was a tremendous master of Greek. In 1614, he published a work in which he showed that Hermes the thrice great, the Egyptian sage, whom you see here as shown on the Siena Cathedral pavement, was actually not an Egyptian sage, but the author of treatises which had been made up in the Roman imperial period and later, though they pretended to be translated from hieroglyphs. And I knew from Francis Yates that his copy of Hermes Trismegistus was in the British Library, and as you see, he kind of wrote the text to death as he assembled all the evidence to show that it was a fake. So he was the kind of person whose opinion I would have loved to have. But how did you get it? Well, here's where contingency plays its first part in our story. I was a Fulbright scholar at University College London, and I had a friend who was a Fulbright scholar at Clare College, Cambridge. And as I was preparing the talk which I was going to give on all this for the seminar of Arnaldo Momigliano, one of the more frightening seminars you can imagine giving a talk in, because Arnaldo Momigliano would sleep through the talk and then wake up and ask questions, and the sleeping was fine, the questions were the bad part. I was really worried about how to assess this, but the British Library closed for a week, and I went off and stayed on the floor of my friend's place in Clare College in order to work in the Cambridge University Library, the magnificent erection, as it was called, at its dedication. And there I was in the university library, and my friend said, do you know about the adversaria? And I said, well, what are adversaria? Adversaria, it turns out, is the collective name for the collection of annotated books in the Cambridge University Library, which is not only a remarkable collection, it had been cataloged by Henry Luard in 1864, and you could buy the catalog for 45 pence in the library office. I bought the catalog, I looked up Casaubon in the index, and my goodness, it turned out that under the magnificent erection was Isaac Casaubon's copy of the book in which Scaliger had published the dynasty list in his effort to defend it. And there, materializing on cue in the margin, was Casaubon saying, I don't see what use these inventions of foolish peoples are for true history. So I was able to establish that this wasn't a terribly plausible kind of argument from the standpoint of the person that Scaliger himself would have thought was better qualified than anyone else in the world to judge. So by 1974, I was pretty convinced that marginalia could tell you all kinds of interesting things, but mostly of a technical kind. And for the next several years, I mostly tended to look at marginalia for technical information, how Scaliger read the book about papyrus. A technical subject I was particularly interested in was the history of Renaissance education. In 1974, I was hired to teach at Cornell University, and I went there. And at the same time, Lisa Jardine, whom you'll be visibly introduced to in a moment, came to Cornell for a year of postdoctoral fellowship. And the two of us attended each other's seminars. We discovered that we really hated everything that everybody had written about Renaissance education, because all they ever talked about was the first orations that teachers gave at the beginnings of their classes, which said, I'm going to give you life, the universe, and everything, all the secrets you can imagine. I'm going to make you moral. I'm going to make you wise. And they never actually looked at what went on in a classroom. And we found ourselves saying, you know, if we could find the right annotations, the sort that students make on teachers' notes, we might actually be able to get a little bit closer inside that classroom. And in 1977, a wonderful collection of annotated teaching books from the University of Paris, these are notes taken by what's basically a high school senior in the first class, the primus ordo of the Collège de Reims, and he's taking notes on his teacher's lectures on a whole series of classical texts. And you can take these, and from them, you can reconstruct how somebody was taught to read a text like this in the Renaissance. Just for one example that you wouldn't necessarily assume, notice the wide blank lines between the lines of the text. The printer put a bar between each two lines of type, leaving that blank so that the teacher could dictate a paraphrase of the text. That's the first thing the teacher did, was to paraphrase it. If it was verse, he would put the word order into prose so it was easier to follow. So this is the very first part of the lesson, is that prose paraphrase. Then he would be dictating explanations of difficult points, identifications of historical and mythical figures, and so on, and slowly the student would fill this up. And from this and other kinds of evidence, Lisa and I wrote a book which infuriated a whole lot of people when it came out in 1986. What we argued was that this process was a really strange one. Once you got into the classroom and saw it, it was as if the teacher held up a finished jigsaw puzzle, just slanted enough so his audience could see it, and then put it down and picked up one piece at a time and explained the pieces, and then put them back into the box, and you never got to see the puzzle again. It's a kind of canonical learning that really only makes sense when a canon is very well established, very well fixed. And we made this argument, and the trouble was collaboration always takes 12 times as long as writing something yourself. The result's better, but it is protracted. And by the time the book came out, the culture wars were going on. And so a book written, conceived in 1974, came out in 1986 and was seen as a contribution to all kinds of things that nobody had been worrying about when we actually wrote. But nonetheless, we were in the margins, we were doing marginal things, but we weren't really worried about that question that Bob and I had talked about in 1980, the history of reading. But now it's the mid-80s. The book is out. We have said all we wanted to say about the history of education. And Bob Darnton is back, pushing harder on the history of reading, with a famous article, the only famous article ever to appear in the Australian Journal of French Studies, 1986, First Steps in the History of Reading, in which he asked again, how do you write the history of reading? And in which he canvassed virtually every possible kind of evidence except books that people had read and left responses in. So this was, shall we say, stimulating. It irked us. How shall I say? It itched us. At this moment, by sheer contingency, Lisa invaded Princeton. Now, and when Lisa invades a place, it knows it's been invaded. Lisa came through Princeton. We talked about the history. She stayed with my wife and me. We talked about the history of reading. She decided to come to make an application to come to my department's research center, which invited foreign scholars. We wrote the application in about 3 hours late one night, put it in. The committee of the center said, yeah, this is fantastic. And Lisa came to Princeton, where we thought we might have a piece of evidence about the history of reading. And that's this. Let me introduce you to Gabriel Harvey and his book. Gabriel Harvey, whom you see on your left, in the only picture we have of him, was a somewhat stormy petrel. He tended to get involved in controversies. One of the big ones, the biggest one, was with Thomas Nash, and this was a bad idea because though Harvey was quite a vigorous writer in the Elizabethan polemical vein, Nash was the best, and Nash crushed him. And Nash wasn't satisfied to have crushed him. Nash had a woodcutter, a block artist, make this block, which shows Harvey letting down his codpiece to let fly upon Ajax, that's a Jakes, a urinal, an Elizabethan invention, as you know, in terror, having heard that Nash's next book is coming out and that he's about to be humiliated. As you can understand, Harvey's been a bit of a figure of fun in literary history. But in fact, Harvey was not an inconsiderable figure in his own time. He was professor of Greek at Cambridge and an important figure in Cambridge University. He was, as we will show in a moment, a member of important political circles. And he was what my teacher Momigliano said, most important for any historical figure. A great man is one thing, but a great man with good handwriting is many times a great man. He had the most beautiful possible handwriting, and he decorated his books with it. And Lisa and I knew that a wonderful gentleman named Lucius Wilmerding had deposited a number of Harvey's books in the Princeton University Library. Now, to get permission to use these, we had to have an interview with Mr. Wilmerding. Mr. Wilmerding was a wonderful old New York gentleman with that New York voice you never hear anymore, almost British and with the sound of very old money behind it. And he interviewed us and decided we were barely respectable and could see his book. The family were great collectors. Before World War II, they owned Montaigne's diary, which they gave to the Bibliothèque Nationale to celebrate the liberation. So they were really an extraordinary family, and perhaps in the Q&A I can tell the story of Mr. Wilmerding and the bank robbers, but I won't digress that far now. So Mr. Wilmerding let us open Gabriel Harvey's Livy, and here you see the book with his flourishing signature and his flourishing signature on top and some completely wrong dates about when he was using it. And this is the book we opened, and this is what it looked like. This is not an annotated book. This is the annotated book. This is a book which is covered with annotations the way a Gothic folly is covered with ivy. Big annotations fill the fly leaves and climb over the empty spaces. Little annotations wreathe themselves around the text. That nervous, brilliant pen of Gabriel Harvey's has turned the book into a kind of manuscript. A kind of manuscript that's difficult to decipher, not because the handwriting is a problem. His handwriting was beautiful, sometimes because the ink has bled through on both sides of the page, but chiefly because the enterprise was extraordinarily puzzling. What on earth was this guy doing to and with this book? So we pressed on and began to try to work this out. And we were able to work out a couple of things. We found, for example, that there were a lot of notes in which Harvey was comparing Livy very systematically with other books, ancient books, modern books. He was taking books that distilled bits of historical learning and writing bits out of them in the margins. He was just compiling, as he does up there, long bibliographies of books that help you with political and historical analysis. So the first thing we tried to do was to get a sense of how this was even physically possible. Here you have this one big book, and you're using it as a kind of center and assembling materials from many other books, systematically going back and forward. And we found it very difficult to imagine the actual conditions. And what happened in this very intense semester of work was that we would end up sitting in our department's lounge, decorated by Trailways Bus Company, drinking cups of really bad tea and arguing ferociously with each other. Now, to imagine this scene, first of all, think of Piglet and Pooh. I mean, it's sort of a very little person and a very big person, one of whom is female and one of whom is male, arguing at each other in the 1980s when male and female people only did that at faculty dinner parties and not in academic settings. And the entire department would stand outside the room worrying about us because we were arguing. And in fact, you know, we're both the kind of Jew who has, you know, two hands for two opinions at the same time. So we loved all of this. So we were one day we were arguing and I said, wait a minute, I know what he was using. And I ran to my office and I came back with a picture of a book wheel, a late Renaissance reading technology. And we looked at it and we said, holy cow, that is the tool for Harvey's job. There you've got the thing he needs. You have the rack that can hold the Livy and Jean Bodin and Anthony Cope and all the other books he's using. It's made for comparative reading. So we realized that we could situate him in a place and in circumstances. And much later, I obtained a book wheel of my own. But again, that's another story. And there you see the members of my course in the history of reading clustered around the book wheel. And we gathered at first people told us these things had never existed since this was a theoretical drawing. But in fact, we were rapidly able to find a number of book wheels even before the existence of Google. There is a book wheel at the Bibliothèque Mazarine. There's a book wheel at the Herzog August Bibliothek in Wolfenbüttel. There are many others. We were also able to find wonderful passages about how these were used. Jacques Cujas, the great Renaissance lawyer, had a book wheel and a barber chair so that he could spin both his books and himself. So we realized that we had hit a late Renaissance mode of reading, that we were onto something. But of course, the question, you know, books do furnish a room, but what do people do with them? What kinds of conclusions were they coming to? What kind of work were they doing? Well, the second thing we realized, and this really came as a much bigger surprise, was that this kind of reading was not solitary. And I think that was one of the things Bob had imagined when he said, that's not reading, is that reading is as we imagine it, sitting in an armchair with the nice pillow and the nice pot of tea and Anna Karenina, sunk in a text, in a silent study. And what we kept finding were notes in which Harvey made clear that he had read this book with other people. In this case, he read three books of Livy with Sir Philip Sidney before Sir Philip Sidney went on his embassy to the Holy Roman Emperor's court in Prague. So suddenly we had a vision of a reading that was not just very elaborate in its technique, that didn't just use all kinds of interesting equipment, but it was a reading that was social and oral and conversational rather than a reading that was silent. And it was a reading carried on with members of the British elite. In fact, it was carried on with members of the Elizabethan War Party, people like Sidney and Thomas Smith Jr. and Leicester, who wanted Elizabeth to be much more engaged in wars on the continent than she, sensible person that she was, actually wanted to be. Harvey is, in a way, the house intellectual to the Cheneys of Elizabethan England. And happily, they didn't have a Bush, so they did much better than we did. Nonetheless, what we were able to establish was that this book was the reminiscence of social readings, that Harvey's attacks on the text were carried out not just by him as an adult, but with adult clients who were already carrying out important social actions, that this was a serious kind of work. And in fact, We came across a letter from Philip Sidney in which he describes reading as reading about the trade of our lives. And this is a letter from him as a political and military figure to another. If a physician must study one thing and a lawyer another, so that with good reason you bend yourself to soldiery, what books can deliver stands in the books that profess the art and in histories. So reading history was a way for people who saw themselves as politically engaged to have the right kind of social standing, the right kind of position in Elizabeth's court, actually to prepare themselves for the public and military life. and we eventually learned to see Harvey as what they would have called a discourser. We called him a facilitator, a professional reader whose real job was less the jobs that paid his salary in Cambridge than to be in London with these elevated people working through texts with him. We also learned, and this is the second point, that reading was an art with rules connected with a kind of formal hermeneutics. Before you sat down with a Philip Sidney to read, you decided how you were going to read, what the goal of the reading was. So here Harvey says, our consideration was chiefly directed at the forms of states, the conditions of persons, and the qualities of actions. We paid little attention to the annotations of Glorianus, who's a Swiss scholar and friend of Erasmus, and others. So reading involves a preliminary meditation on what you actually hope to achieve, a deliberate choice among tactics. And in fact, as we went through the text, we saw that Harvey had really made political tracks through it, using signs even to identify points. So JC there, Juris Consultus, is a sign that there's a legal or constitutional message in the text. The sign of Mercury is a sign that diplomatic questions are involved, and the astrological sign of Mars that military matters are involved. Sometimes you find just Mars, 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 Mars all the way down the side when you're hitting the description of a battle. So we realized that this was a kind of reading that tried to historicize itself by leaving the tracks that it had cut in the labyrinth of the text in the text, made visible, hedged about, and emphasized by signs and notes. And that we thought that really helped to explain why Harvey signed and dated his books. He really saw them as the record of a world in which he was engaged, a particular political world. So this was how far we got in one semester. So we asked Lawrence Stone if we could give a presentation to the Shelby Cullum Davis Center, not on the canonical Friday, but on a Wednesday, and he allowed us to do this. We wore matching neckties made by my wife, and we rose to our full 5'2" and presented this material to the world of the Princeton History Department as it then was. Peter Brown, Natalie Davis, Lawrence Stone, Bob Darton reappearing, and brilliant graduate students. Rachel Weil, now a distinguished historian at Cornell, was one of the brilliant graduate students in that cohort. And none of them had ever seen anything quite like it. They were somewhat puzzled, but they thought we were onto something. And they gave us what we felt was a sufficiently positive response that we felt able to send our paper off. We sent it off to one distinguished journal, Representations, which sent it right back, as was insufficiently theorized. Bear this in mind, we were both fairly prominent scholars at this point. This is the most influential paper either of us has ever written, and it was turned down by the first journal we tried, so never be discouraged. But then we sent it to Past and Present, where it appeared, and that really was, we think, the beginning of the sort of history of margins in the Renaissance as a kind of formal activity. So, at the end of the time when Lisa and I are writing, I'm in her house in Maid's Causeway, and we hear the sound of a skateboard.
I'm happy to stay in the margins, I have to say. How do you interrupt that? I guess with a skateboard. So I had come from Columbia as an undergraduate to Cambridge in 1988. Lisa, of course, had just returned from Princeton, full of ideas about margins. But I had a very different training and a very different frame from the one that Tony has described. And in many ways, I still do. I had an English department training. I had a new historicist, anthropologically inflected theory background, so reading tons of Bakhtin. Bakhtin prepared me for the idea of the dialogue of multiple voices in a text, of the encounter with others. Almost carnivalesque, almost every Bakhtinian idea worked for the margins, but I didn't really know what margins were yet, and I hadn't really thought much about readers. But I then did encounter a lot of hardcore reader response, and in particular, I was very drawn to Stanley Fish's work, and to the kinds of theories that were helping us to think about how texts constrain the works of readers and the operations of readers. And I was very excited by all of these ideas, open text, interaction between readers who fill gaps and authors who leave them, all of those things. But I was gradually aware that we had every kind of reader except the real reader. The implied reader, Wolfgang Iser, the model reader, Umberto Eco, the super reader, Rifater, who was at Columbia teaching narratology when I was there, inscribed or encoded readers, and the mock reader, and of course, above all, the ideal reader. Well, what about the less than ideal reader? What about the real reader, the actual reader? So I was curious about that. I came from my master's to Cambridge. Again, contingency. Lisa had been in Princeton and therefore had not been, in the classic Cambridge fashion, assigned any students. They forgot about that while she was away. So she came back. I arrived. I won't go into all the details about why they wouldn't let me do the degree that I had been awarded a fellowship to do. So instead, they said, well, there's this new MPhil in Renaissance Studies. You can do that. And there's this person, Lisa Jardine, who's just come back, and you know, you can have her as a supervisor. Well, so I was very, very lucky because I had two people who taught me an enormous amount in the margins and about the margins. Lisa, and I love that picture. It's one of my absolute favorites. And the other person is Patrick Collinson, so the new Regius Professor of History arrived with a very traditional ecclesiastical history background and interest, but with an almost shocking, to this day, mission to legitimate other kinds of history. And he authorized particularly the work that Lisa and Keith Wrightson, a great social historian now at Yale, were doing together at Jesus College. So they had a social history seminar, they had a kind of a new historicism reading group, and Pat was really extraordinarily supportive. So they became my two supervisors for first the master's and then the PhD. And that really was a matter of the most almost providence rather than contingency. And with Pat's interests, I think that's probably true. The other thing that I had is training. And in 1988-9, the first year of this new MPhil, I'm not sure if it's continued, I think it may have, but paleography, how to read old handwriting, was the one thing that we were tested on. I mean, everything else, fine. If you want to, you know, say what this metaphor means, okay. But you've got to know the different kinds of handwriting, the different materialities of textual communication and transmission. And that was just, again, not something I planned to acquire or even probably valued at the moment. But without it, I would absolutely not have done any of the work that I've gone on to do. So I'm going to put in a big word for paleography. So shout out to all our paleography friends. And I think that's really, really crucial to this day. But I didn't really know where to put all of this work, and I had been kind of floundering around. And I was deeply drawn to our second great case study, John Dee. Now, John Dee was not an obvious person to be studying in this context. Dee was known, to the extent that he was, as a wizard, as a marginal figure. Francis Yates, who Tony's already mentioned, had studied him extensively and needed him extensively as the authorizer of an occult trend in the Renaissance, you know, really the embodiment of this new magical version of the Renaissance. And Dee was so disembodied that I'm to this day not quite sure why I decided to look at him. I immediately found Elizabethan England's largest library, so that was lucky. About 4,000 books in the 1580s when it was cataloged, by far the biggest library of his day. That library allowed me to do magic to Dee, to put Dee back in touch with the intellectual enterprises, with the people who employed him, with the jobs he did, and this idea of the trade of our lives. I thought, well, does a wizard have a trade? You know, what did he have a job? Who pays for the wizard? And so I suddenly thought, well, you know, you don't just acquire 4,000 books in this period. And as it happens, he had a tremendously complicated line of credit in continental booksellers and an enormous amount of debt by the time he died because of it. But a fascinating set of materials survive, and I threw myself into them. Again, luck, Cambridge had, for odd reasons, an unusual share of the surviving books. About 500 have been identified from his 4,000 original books. I'm sure others are out there. There's another story to be told, I think, in this, is how much stuff continues to emerge, to become visible later. So I finally did settle on D. I had my reader. I think I don't, unfortunately, because I'm away from home and we only decided to do this recently, have any really good pictures of Dee's marginalia, but I do have a fairly typical set of astrological data in a book of Dee's at the British Library, including several of what we will soon know as the manicule, several of his pointing hands in this very distinctive form. But Dee was an extremely active reader, and it just made Dee look different. That was the bottom line. The material that it gave me access to did not fit the image of an isolated wizard. It connected him above all to the, not the Protestant war party Tony was talking about, but the aggressive expansionists and imperialists. And Dee coined the phrase British Empire and was an extremely enterprising reader for precedent, for historical precedent material, to justify basically, sounds silly now, but, well, actually it doesn't. It sounded silly then, Elizabeth's right to basically the entire Northern Hemisphere. Well, it happened later, but I think that was what surprised me. So I did D, and it went really well, and I was very, very happy. But the next question was, and it's back to the ADV class, the Adversaria class in the Cambridge University Library. I thought, okay, we have these two figures. They're a bit weird, Gabriel Harvey and John Dee. They are themselves sort of marginal figures from the moment, from that period. How do they fit in? Are they typical? Were these kinds of practices just one-offs or two-offs? How do we know? So I had a first look around the rest of this Adversaria collection because they're primarily books associated with Cambridge. Dee was trained in Cambridge. Harvey was trained in Cambridge. Thought, okay. Well, I got some distance with it, but then I thought, no, I really need a big picture. So in 93, after I finished the PhD, but before the book on Dee came out, I was given a full summer fellowship at the Huntington Library. More contingency. Just utterly changed my life. In all kinds of ways. This is a beautiful shot of the outside, which I don't think I saw very much because I looked at 7,500 books in the course of a couple of weeks. And I ended up in the rare book stacks. Another really crucial enabler is librarians willing to give you access to things. And this was an incredible gift that it was partly because of the layout of the rare book stacks. I was supervised technically by the pagers in the book stacks, and so they let me just go in there. I had to check in. I would go in the morning. They'd not quite frisk me, but check me out when I left, and that was it. And I did it all day, every day. And I covered what is called the STC collection, the short title catalog, so all printed books held by this particular collection, which is one of the biggest in the world, from the period of the beginning of printing to 1640. And I wanted to see on a big scale, what do you learn? What kinds of big patterns do you come up with? So I did that, and moving from reader-level work to library-level work offered a bunch of new things. This is probably the most immediately striking, which is when you can look at multiple copies of the same work. This is the same page of the same edition of the same work in three copies. As it happens, these are all at the Folger, not at the Huntington. So Sacrobosco's famous book on the sphere of the world, 1482. And as you can see, I mean, I don't expect you can read it, but all three of those are fundamentally different approaches to what material there are preserved there. So that idea of even what the same book is started to be very interesting to me and to open up. More broadly, the survey across the Huntington, and this is back to our not reading idea, challenged me to think, well, wait a minute, this isn't the kind of reading that in an English department in particular, and in literary criticism, I was taught to look for. I was finding traces of all kinds in the margins of books that took me beyond reading or made much, much more capacious and much more complex the idea of what reading is. So using books as archives for holding histories of your family, or holding the family scissors, as you can see in a copy of the first folio, the Shakespeare first folio from the Folger. And actually, there are two copies of the folio at the Folger that have rusty scissors imprints in them. Interesting question. Also, a lot of just what we would probably call scribbles, but actually are attempts to emulate visual or typographical inscription. A lot of practice of writing, a lot of coloring. And again, I thought that was quite interesting to start to work on. The one next to it is one of my favorite examples because it's back to Isaac Casaubon, one of the most learned men in the world ever, reading one of the most learned books, Francis Bacon's Advancement of Learning. And it's fascinating because what I found is there is, you know, some pretty impressive cross-referencing at the bottom, but basically what he was using it for is practicing his pronunciation of English. Every word with more than one syllable has the accented syllable marked. So unexpected window on the coming together of these two extraordinary figures. And that's really the moral of the story for me, is that I started to find that every single book, if you look carefully, poses a mystery. And Roger Stoddard, one of the great pioneers in this field, wrote that every book contains 1,000 mysteries that can teach us a lot if we can make them out. And I did start to find that that was the case, and I found that I needed, and it took a long time. I'm not as efficient as Tony. And I was thinking, well, I'm not finding the evidence for the answers to the questions that I think I'm asking. So what new questions is this evidence posing? So that was the way I started to approach it, is how does it open up new perspectives? And it did so in an unexpected way when I started to notice something that clearly had been pointing at me, literally, ever since I first started reading. I mean, the pointing hand is everywhere, absolutely everywhere. But I suddenly became aware of it and suddenly found a name for it, the manicule, which hasn't stuck, but let's go with it for now. This copy here is absolutely astonishing, and I thought, now wait a minute, why is somebody writing, it's a Catholic book with extremely rabidly Protestant marginalia, why is somebody not only putting these very sharp, most of the manicules actually point at the text rather than away from it, but stitching red thread anywhere there's a particularly sharp point? Well, it turns out it's Richard Topcliffe, who was the great torturer of Catholics in Queen Elizabeth's court. So it's quite an, and this is a person who was executed, the text. It's quite a nasty example. That one is a little bit happier, the sort of rubbery finger version of the manicule. But I thought, all right, what is going on with the manicule? What kind of interface is this between the body of the reader and the mind of the author, or the mind of the text? And I started to see the importance of nonverbal marks, often visual marks rather than verbal ones, the continuities with medieval textuality, which were all over the place suddenly, instead of this new world of the Renaissance printed book. But also the long life of some of these things. So the great example from the Renaissance period that I ended up putting on the cover of my book, Used Books, was a figure, Pietro Bembo, Bernardo Bembo, Pietro Bembo's father. And this is a fantastic example, and I can come back to talk more about that later. Other discoveries have come out of it. But this was the kind of thing that I was able to start pursuing, is what is the long afterlife of the pointing hand in typographic culture and industrial culture, and then, of course, in popular culture with Glovey from Yellow Submarine doing the dirty work for the Blue Meanies. But also, does anybody know what that is in the lower right? Exactly. It's the Apple Lisa graphic user interface. It's the first template for the pointing hand that is still there in digital culture. And it was very much, if you read the guys who designed it, about putting the digit in digital. It was about the finger and about the manual act of learning, of acquiring language and acquiring learning. So that was the biggest surprise for me, is the sort of discovery of the first graphic user interface in the form of the manicule. Now, back to Tony.
While all this was going on, I was continuing to plow my own fields, which tended to be, which also gradually moved from single users who interested me to something bigger, but in a different way, which illustrates another facet of this work. I began to look systematically at all of the annotated books that belonged to the people who interested me. This is a book which belonged to Joseph Scaliger. It's a copy of an edition of the Roman astronomical poet Manilius, whom he had edited in 1579. This is a reprint done in 1590 by Franciscus Junius, in which Junius adds a short commentary in which he...
Should we let him in?
Shall we?
Now, there is a sign on the door.
The person will read the sign.
Okay. So Junius published this commentary in which he not only corrected Scaliger, he was right on the number of points, but also said if Scaliger were here, he would have said this was a great idea, exactly what I should have done. This is Scaliger's response. And so one of I'm particularly fond of the points where he says, cockot, cockot. Literally, he's full of shit. One of the things I realized if you pursued Scaliger was you could get him into Bill's world of using books in all kinds of ways that were not the sort of thing you were supposed to do in the genteel world of scholarship. But the scholar that I found engrosses me most and has also engrossed at least one of my students and is just the greatest of readers is Isaac Casaubon. Casaubon, who charts his reading in a magnificent journal, I rose at 5, he says, alas, how late, who read for 6 or 7 hours a morning, infuriated only when friends visited him, amici inimici, my friends are my enemies. He would read 50 or 60 folio pages of Greek in a morning. He refused even to interrupt his reading to go to the bathroom. And so when he died and he was dissected by the great surgeon, Turquet de Mayerne, it was discovered that he had died from reading. This is his bladder. And when his complete letters were published, rather than give a portrait of him, they gave the portrait of his bladder as a magnificent sign of Protestant asceticism. This is the exact equivalent of the consumed heart of the Catholic saint of the same moment, reduced to ashes. So this is a reader. This is someone for whom reading was a profound act, and he even tells us that he combed his hair every morning before going upstairs to read his books, a little bit like Machiavelli entertaining the ancients in his golden robes. And one project in particular drew me, and again, a friend. In 1977, my friend Joanna Weinberg, a very great Judaic scholar who now teaches at Oxford, found this book in the British Library and noticed that in the margins, it's a prayer book, someone was translating bits of it into Greek in the 16th century. And, you know, the idea of translating a Jewish prayer book into Greek is interesting, so she took this to Arnaldo Momigliano, our teacher, whom you see there in a characteristic pose, and said, do you know anything about this? And he said, well, of course, that's Isaac Casaubon's Greek handwriting. You should do something about that. And I should say that the bacon that Bill found, the most wonderful thing about that is that when he was unsure of an English word or phrase, he translated it into Greek in the margins. He's the only person who's ever learned English by putting it into classical Greek. So, as I said, collaboration is the thief of time. So a mere 28 years after Joanna told Arnaldo told Joanna she should do something, she and I began. And we started by looking at things we knew told some kind of story about Isaac Casaubon in Hebrew. There was, for example, a copy, and you see this on your left, of David Kimchi's Hebrew Grammar, the Sefer Michlal, Book of Perfection or Completion, which had been discovered in the 19th century, in which actually had Kosobin's signature on the title page. The Jewish bibliographer who discovered it, being unable to imagine that a Christian could possibly have owned the book, invented a rabbi, Rabbi Yitzhak Kazuban, and attributed it to this. And it took the great Solomon Schechter to explain, no, it was actually Isaac Kosobin. There was a list of Kosobin's books in the Bodleian, which included Hebrew books. So at the top, Mercier on Job is a great Christian Hebraist. Pretty two-thirds of the way down, you see the Mora Nebuchim, the Guide to the Perplexed, in Hebrew and Latin. So we began to notice that he'd actually owned a fair number of Hebrew books, though no one who wrote about him ever mentioned such a thing, including Mark Pattison, whose biography of Kosobin is one of the great works of Victorian fiction. So we decided to see what we could find out. And we decided to see, using the British Library, into which most of Kosobin's books had gone on his death, they went into the Royal Library, we decided to see if we could find what kind of reader of Hebrew he was. So we employed a highly sophisticated research method, the only one we could. We ordered every Hebrew book in the British Library printed before his death and looked at them all. And we began to learn interesting things. This, for example, is one of his Jewish prayer books, and here you see him at the bottom translating the prayer in which an Orthodox Jew thanks God for not making him a woman. Further up, you can see him having more trouble with the prayer where you are grateful for a good bowel movement and having been provided with all the right orifices. This baffled him, not surprisingly. He read a number of Jewish prayer books, and we were gratified to see, as two Jews, though unobservant ourselves, that he really liked Jewish prayer books. What he really liked were the slichot, the penitential prayers from the Day of Repentance. Being a good Calvinist, if he'd been a Catholic, he'd have gone to Our Lady of of perpetual depression. But as a good Calvinist, he really liked repenting. He said, those Jews really know how to repent. So he read prayer books, and he compared prayer books. He was interested in the difference between Sephardic and Ashkenazic prayer books. But his reading really went much wider. This is a prayer for visiting a graveyard from the Roman prayer book. And here, since he couldn't get a copy of it, he actually copied it out in his own extremely neat hand. Here, even more surprisingly, is his note in a copy of Sefer Chassidim, the great strange book of the Rhineland Pietists of the Middle Ages. This is a book which is full of all kinds of things, stories, all kinds of information about the Jewish book trade, dominated by women, in fact, and he actually talks about that in his note. So he's actually reading this in a very critical, interested way. And he singles out one story in Sefer Chassidim for comment. And it's a magnificent story. There's a Jewish couple, they're married, and the husband refuses to buy books. So the wife refuses to go to the ritual bath. And that means no sex. This is Lysistrata in the shtetl. And until he buys books, she won't go to the mikveh. And finally, a rabbi comes and has an intern, does a little bit of negotiation and arbitration. He buys books. She goes to the mikveh. Everybody's happy. And Kosobin writes, what a beautiful story, in the margin. Now, when I tell you that Kosobin himself, at almost the same time, is writing in his diary, oh, my God, my whole family is in debt. I've spent all our money on books. I'd better wait till Madame Kosobin gets back from France to spend any more. I won't buy any more books unless I see something really valuable. You see that this sort of whole yeshiva bocher thing was something that he had a real kind of elective affinity with. So by going through the whole library and pulling out his whole library, which we eventually reconstructed, it was actually the biggest Hebrew library in England at the time of his death in 1614, we were able to get a sense of the person that was infinitely richer than any sense you'd have been able to have otherwise. a sense of someone who actually would pray in Hebrew. This is from one of his copies of The Characters of Theophrastus, which he was editing, and he says, Shavach la'el, borei misspelled olam, praise to God, creator of the universe. The fact that he misspells is interesting because it means he's writing very quickly, and it's you can understand phonetically how he does the misspelling, but it's really extraordinary to see a Calvinist starting work one day with a prayer in Hebrew. And this turned out to be tremendously meaningful. It actually turned out that his passion for Hebrew was also the sign of a kind of openness to Judaism. This expressed itself personally in 1613. In May 1613, he went to Oxford, and in the Bodleian Library, he met a Jew, a young Jew named Jacob Barnett from Italy. And the two of them became bosom buddies. They read the Talmud together. And these are actually notes that Kassaubin took as he read the Talmud with Jacob Barnett. This is actually a blasphemous passage about Jesus, the hanged one, one of the passages that made the Talmud really problematic to Christian thinkers. And they're reading it, and Jacob is explaining it's not in the Basel edition of the Talmud because that was censored, but it is in the Venice editions of the Talmud. And you can see all of that. And here, Jacob is teaching him terminology. And the really interesting thing here is that Kassaubin has written the word bar aita, which is one word, and it means an expression which is kind of transmitted and is reasonably authoritative, but not deeply so. He's written it as if it's two words. So we know we're at a lesson. We know we're at one of these conversations about reading, where the two men are talking and going over this extraordinary text. So this story ends in an extraordinary way because Jacob went back to London with Kassaubin. They spent a few more weeks reading the Talmud. Then Jacob went back to Oxford. The Oxford authorities decided that Jacob would convert to Christianity. They were going to make him a professor of Hebrew because he could actually read Hebrew, unlike the professor of Hebrew. It seemed like a good idea. So they decided to convert him, and not just to convert him, they were going to have him convert on the first Sunday of the fall term in St. Mary's Church, the one with the twisty pillars on the high street in Oxford. And they give him lessons, and they talk to him, and they write to Kassaubin and say, what do you think? And he says, I think this is a really terrible idea. He's full of this Talmud stuff. It's blasphemous. He's a sweet guy, but he's not a Christian, but he meant what he was saying, but they didn't listen. And then they wrote to Kassaubin again and said, by the way, do you know the liturgy for converting a Jew? Because we don't have any Jews in England. We've never done this. And Kassaubin writes back and says, don't do it. But so on the Saturday before the first Sunday of this fall term, they go to find Jacob Barnett, and he has scarpered. He has put on a backpack and run away. So men go after him. They catch him on the London Road. They bring him back to Oxford. They put him in the university jail, Bocardo, which was next to Pret-a-Manger in the corn market, if you know the corn market. It was actually the city arch, which was a standard place for jails. And the professors start good cop, bad copping him. They do everything but waterboard him. Thomas James, Bodley's librarian, comes in and says, you know what my ancestors did to your ancestors at York? Not a nice thing to say. But happily, there was a grumpy Scot who made his living as a Greek scribe in Oxford named Peter Goldman, not Jewish, a Silesian. Peter Goldman didn't like the English, and he did like Jacob Barnett, who had taught him Hebrew. Goldman signs one of his Greek manuscripts in the British Library, Kephas Bar Zahav, Meir HaGadolah Dundee, Peter the son of gold from the great city of Dundee, which had about 40 inhabitants. So he writes to Kassaubin in Greek and says, they're doing terrible things. You have to help. And Kassaubin, who was barely 5 feet tall, actually never did learn to speak English and was tormented in the street by urchins who yelled, hey, froggy, and threw stones at him, and had no power whatsoever, managed to intervene through his friends in the episcopate with the king to get Jacob Barnett released from jail and sent to France, where I'm happy to say he turns up as the French monarchy's expert on Jewish affairs. He was a man of parts. So this is one quite extraordinary story in a very dark era of Jewish-Christian relations. But the intellectual story is in a way even deeper, because the other thing that fascinated Kassaubin was the Jewish roots of Christianity, in which he delved very deeply in these last years. And so for Kassaubin, By the end of his life, it was absolutely clear that Christianity was, in its way, one more Jewish sect, like the Essenes and other Jewish sects he'd written about. And he was able to demonstrate this in great depth and detail in the last great book that he wrote. This is an insight which, of course, became widespread in the 17th century to be forgotten in the 18th and revived again in the 19th and 20th, among the many stories of loss of knowledge. So one of the great texts for Casaubon in this inquiry was the Greek writing of Flavius Josephus, the Jewish general who is captured, goes over to the Romans, becomes a favorite at the Roman imperial court, and writes the history of the war that ended in the conquest of Jerusalem and the destruction of the Second Temple in AD 70, and writes a great history of Israel based on the Bible. So this is Casaubon's copy of Josephus, which he worked through with his customary energy. And here you see him working on one passage in particular. There's a passage in Josephus which tells the story of Jesus and says Jesus was a true prophet and his execution was wrong. This is called the Testamentum Flavianum. It has been controversial for a long time. The interesting thing is what Casaubon writes in the margin, which is, Jesus, but did Josephus actually write this? This is the always critical reader. Whatever his passion, he's never going to assume that any text is genuine or rightly ascribed until he's worked through it critically. Sure though he is that Judaism and Christianity are intimately connected, he's not ready to believe that a Jew like Josephus could say this about the Christian prophet. Over to you, Bill.
To uncritical reading. So last September, Tony and I go back to the University Library in Cambridge, back to the Adversaria collection for one more book, and it's our old friend Thomas Smith, and it's the same book, the same copy, the same edition, rather, of the same Josephus text. And as you can see, where Casaubon is critical, not so for Thomas Smith, fairly straightforwardly not critical, but also not straightforwardly visual for a Protestant reader in Elizabethan England. And it's a puzzlingly visual response, and it turns out not to be unique. All through the Josephus, there are acts of envisioning what is described that are genuinely surprising, maybe nowhere more so than when Josephus himself says, this cannot be envisioned. And so this is the cherubs on the ark, you know, in the Adiutum, he set up two cherubim of solid gold, this is the text, each 5 cubits in height and each having 2 wings with a spread of 5 cubits, with their inner wings joined each other so as to form a covering for the ark, which was placed between them. But as for the cherubim themselves, no one can say or imagine what they looked like. Well, didn't stop Thomas Smith. He drew them. So there they are. That's what they look like. And this is one last example of a reader that is teaching us new ways of thinking about the evidence of the past. Smith turns out not to be unusual. I think he's unusually obsessed with lives in the margins and in rendering them visually in the form of heads with exotic hats. But there's Cleopatra and Jonathan and Alexander. And he doesn't just stop with the ancient world. He carries on. This is modern France. And, you know, he really goes for it. It turns out this is really our last example for now before we open it up for some conversation about this, that there are a lot of interesting ways now that we're pursuing this idea that, well, for all this time, we've really been thinking about marginalia as a verbal phenomenon, as words next to words. But you've already seen the graphic nature of the interaction between the reader's hand and the page. And there is something fundamentally visual about that act of reading. And so the final thing I wanted to just show is two examples from my current work, The Reader's Eye, about that fundamental interconnection, I think, between drawing and reading. And I have come to think that the two were deeply intertwined, even where they weren't supposed to be. Now, this is a place where they are supposed to be because Dante is a deeply visual poet. The response to Dante is unusually visual. There are very few examples of Dante manuscripts that don't have some kind of visual rendering. This, however, is utterly unique. This is a copy of the great Landino Dante, the 1481 landmark edition of Dante's text with the extremely dense and learned commentary of Landino. 1481 copy, and this is in the Biblioteca Valliceliana in Rome, and it has exquisite drawings throughout the book, all through all three books, and it's not yet clear who they are, but one thing that's clear is that this is a person who loves similes. The only place they draw a picture, with one exception, is where there is a simile. So wherever there is come or qual, wherever there's like or as, you get the drawing. So here's one of the great examples, the end of Inferno Canto 5 with Paolo and Francesca. Such a moving story, of course. Remember that Dante swoons at the end of the canto. So at the end, and I fell like a dead body falls. That is not Dante, that is the dead body. Now, that is an extremely unusual mode of response because every single depiction of the Divine Comedy shows Dante and Virgil. You see them in action, making their way through. This never shows them. This shows you the similes by which the natural world usually is compared to the things that Dante is describing. Here you've got the leaves, new leaves follow old leaves. You've got the angels being compared famously to the bees around the white rose. This is one last example because it's opening up some interesting ideas here about the space of the page. Again, I think we've only begun to understand how the space of the page works and the ways in which a printed page was a live space and had depth and I think and movement. And this is a great example from the Dante, but it takes us back to our very first slide and the image that we used on our publicity, which is this extraordinary, and really at the other end of the artistic spectrum in many ways, this is an amateur apothecary, rural apothecary in Kent, who bought this copy of the 1708 Aesop, the Lestrange edition. And it's interesting because the preface to this Lestrange edition says, "We need illustrations to learn." But there are no pictures. And he's not talking about picture illustrations. He's talking about examples. We need illustrations that we can compare things to. And so what it has, as you can see, is this moral, the reflection, all of these verbal illustrations. But this apothecary, we think for his daughters who also signed the book, went through and did the most charming illustrations throughout the book. But they're not just charming, they're incredibly sophisticated in the way they interact with the word. And so that example over there that you can see, the fable where it's a country fellow sowing seeds or sowing his grounds, and he's sowing on the word sowing. And the interaction with the page is as interesting, I'd say, as any artist book I've ever seen. I mean, it goes back to medieval illumination and ahead all the way up to the graphic novel and beyond. And so I think it's a really interesting example maybe to end on because it really opens it up. We focus so much on the Renaissance period, inevitably, but it really, I think, opens this question up to a much broader purview. So that's where I'm headed with it. That's a lot to take in, and I hope that tour of our lives in the margins was interesting, but we'd love to hear from you about your stories and your experiences in the margins. And anything to add, Tony?
No, just if you can find a way to let us out, I think we probably wouldn't take it.
I mean, we're happy just to do Q&A, but
yeah, if there are questions, I have a microphone just so we can record.
Before we do that, can I just ask how many of you write in your books? Okay. Who really, really doesn't? Ah, see, that's what I wanted to show. Tony and I have very, very different practices. It's really interesting. I think that we could have started there, actually, and talked a lot about why and why not, and how not. But maybe that'll come up later or on another day, another event. But
Yeah, questions?
Jacqueline Cantwell, senior law librarian in the New York City Surrogates Court.
Oh,
this has been a real eye-opening for me in what you've been writing about. One of the things I do in the library is to go through the documents of the older surrogates, okay? So this was one of the court attorneys showed me the notebooks of a surrogate who was who's very well respected, very learned, okay? And he wrote notes during trial with pictures of the person, liar. Hardworking, but dim-witted, okay? And I'm thinking, okay, so he's working with this very stable platform in front of him. Paper is a stable platform. It allows an intimacy for thinking. Now my judges are working with an online case management system that's very, very distancing, that doesn't allow that intimacy of thought. That, you know, it's great for docketing, for marking what's going on, but it doesn't allow an involvement of thought. So I'm going to go back looking at these materials, and maybe we law librarians are going to have to start thinking about better ways for people to think with materials, because you've shown that people could use books to think, help them think. And right now, the big push for me is, like, buy the latest electronic book. I've just got another tool to say it's not going to help my people in processing.
Right.
I mean, I'm really happy.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I would just, can I add quickly to that an example that I wanted to show, but it was so far off the chronological scope that I didn't do it. Is a really interesting example of it's related to the piece I did in Cabinet on cryptography. So the founding figure in the 20th century of modern military cryptography, this guy William Friedman, he wrote an extraordinarily scathing set of annotations in his copy of Herbert Yardley's The American Black Chamber, the really notorious 1931 book, which was a tell-all account of the recently closed intelligence code-breaking agency, which was closed with the famous line, "Gentlemen don't read gentlemen's mail." And that's an extraordinary example of something that I think you're getting at there, which is about, you said it's a stable platform. It's also, it's interesting because he never uttered anything in public about this case. It absolutely infuriated him, and you can see it on every page in this book, but that book stayed on his shelves. It was about a private setting of the record straight, but in a durable place. And, of course, now it is in the public record, and we've just digitized it, and anyone can look at it. And it's an extraordinary example of that kind of private record for perpetuity. And it's not private anymore, and I'm not sure in a way it ever really, really is private. So it's a very helpful, helpful example.
I have two questions, one extremely important that everyone wants answered, I think, and the other fairly trivial. The crucial question is, we want more details on the skateboard, because without that, this lecture isn't complete. And the trivial question is there any sense that printing itself causes visuality to move to the margins? That is there a difference between the relationship between a mechanized text and visual annotations and handwritten text? Is there a sense that when it's handwritten, you don't need to annotate in the same way, or maybe not, you don't need to annotate it visually if it's already illuminated?
You take the skateboard. It was your skateboard.
It was. Well, what do you want to know about it? I mean,
everything. You teased us. How did the skateboard appear?
It had William Burroughs on the bottom. And it had, you know, that was it.
No.
Oh, deeply.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you literally skateboard up to Tony Grafton's door and say,
Lisa Jardine's door,
I want to do more paleography?
Pretty much.
Most skateboarders have similar feelings, I think.
That's it.
I recall Jeff Scholson came on foot, but you came on skateboard. And Lisa would be there with her brooch, which said multum in parvo, much in little, which was highly appropriate. So on the transition from the manuscript to print, the real answer is we don't know yet because of the separation of specialisms, because there's manuscript people and printed book people. And in fact, the two worlds interlace for at least a couple of hundred years. But there are many unexpected continuities. Mm-hmm. I mean, one thing that I really thought was a print phenomenon was the textbook classic that we showed you with the bars between the lines. That seemed really obviously to be a feature of print. In fact, that goes deep back into the 15th century and probably before as a form of manuscript layout of exactly the same kind of book. So the scribe would lay out the lines with space for the student to enter a paraphrase. And the manicule, as Bill has shown, is a medieval practice that comes right on down until it's deprived of meaning but continues with Google Books. Where you get the involuntary manicule quite regularly. So I think the real answer is we're not that. It's a real problem. There are people trained with manuscripts. There are people trained with printed books. Very few people really cross that border, and it's one of the most important things for another generation to do is to be able to cross that border really well. So somewhere on a skateboard.
Thanks, Blake.
I was wondering if either of you encountered, or if you did, what kind of secret marginalia, as for example, in communist Russia, it was pretty common to use, for example, milk, to write in milk, and then when you hold it over a fire, a secret message comes out.
Oh, boy. That's probably for me. Yeah. I've certainly seen marginalia in code, which is useful. There's a very interesting book, Alessio's Book of Secrets. It was extremely popular, very, very widespread, Italian book that in Elizabethan England is reproduced and reproduced. And it has all kinds of instructions about how to do secret writing, invisible writing of various kinds. And, you know, I have never, I mean, partly because, you are literally forbidden to kindle a flame in the Bodleian Library. And that's what you need for most citrus-based secret writing. So no source of heat sufficient to reveal the hidden ink. But I have wondered, I mean, this is really getting a little silly, but, I mean, Dan Lewis from the Huntington and I, who's curator of the history of science there, have talked about a kind of forensic study of old books. And we think, well, what the heck is preserved? I mean, there must be, all kinds of extinct animals and maybe Newton's DNA, and there are all kinds of things preserved in the margins that aren't visible or known yet. But there are also visible things, just simply things like the example that Bob Darnton about the fingerprint of the printer, which Maddie back there, wherever she is, has done similar work with Protestant Reformation readers. But that's an interesting idea.
One thing that actually Bill knows more about than I do is there are many, many marginalia which have been made secret because in the 19th century, marginalia were thought to defile a book. And unless they were by someone recognizable like Gabriel Harvey, they were washed chemically. So vast numbers of books have been washed so thoroughly that the marginalia are impossible to recover or can only be recovered technically. Before that, there was dry point, which would leave grooves in the page, yes, but not actually leave pigment. So the great Michael McCormick at Harvard picked up an early manuscript of Virgil, took it to the window of the Vatican manuscript room, and there found the 500 glosses that he published in Studia Testi, a lost commentary on Virgil from the 6th century, entered in dry point. So there are those secret forms.
Also, there's one other example that I've come across, which is that they talk about using the dint of a nail is the phrase they use. So your fingernail to mark, or thumbnail, to mark a passage, usually just a line down the margin. But actually, it's one of those things that, how many times have I turned past what might have been really significant pieces of evidence? I don't know. But now that I'm looking, I see all kinds of things like that.
Isaac Newton turned down the corners of pages very precisely to point at the things he was interested in. Mm-hmm. And, of course, many librarians straightened these out and ironed the pages. But now, if you have a Newton book, you're very careful not to fix them. This is a method which everyone disapproved of. It's known as ass's ears in the pedagogical literature. Yeah.
Hi, I was very taken by your example of the swollen bladder, and I'm wondering if you found other evidence of readers' physical bodies in the text, fatigue, spills, those kinds of interruptions?
Not as many as you'd expect. And it seems to me that books are often read pen in hand on a stand. And that would be one of the things that would explain why I found very little wine spilled on books, which I would really have expected to find a lot more than I have in books that people worked on very heavily. So on the whole, I think that there is still a certain, even when you're working a book and inscribing things onto it, there's a certain reticence about dirtying it or doing that. But the body of the scholar is hugely interesting in this period because it's only really in the 15th century and onwards that you get scholars who were allowed to have sexually active bodies, who are actually allowed to marry, to live in houses, to have, as Philip Melanchthon did, let his little granddaughter come in and pee on the floor of his study. And that must make a huge difference, but I haven't yet been able to find physical evidence of it in the books, perhaps happily. I think almost certainly that's the reading stand. You know the two paintings of Augustine and Jerome and Ogni Santi in Florence. Mm-hmm. That kind of reading stand, I think, must have been very, very common. Mm-hmm. Got some down here. Oh, there's one in the back. Good.
I was just curious. Have you found any texts on this, like about anxiety of defacement? Of what these images do to the text.
A lot. I expected not to find any of that because people were doing it all over the place. I mean, it does actually seem to be the norm and to be trained in this culture. But there are examples where people say, I lent you this book and it comes back and it's full of your notes. Buy me a new one. I actually have a couple examples of that. But And of course, there are library regulations when you get into the history of when libraries are used by a community or when they're owned by a corporate group, you start to get that kind of thing. When they're part of a much more commercialized book trade in secondhand materials, you start to get those. You do get those. But what surprises us more, I think, is it's the opposite. So I've had several cases. One is here in the New York Academy of Medicine Library where the subsequent reader says, I bought this book because it has the notes by John Dee, or in that case it is Dee. People commenting on the added value, as we say. Of these marginal annotations.
And in some way, in the Renaissance, if you look at the first book auction catalogs, they always mark the... So when Scaliger's was the second auction to be cataloged ever and printed, the books with his notes are marked with asterisks, and they got higher prices than they would have without. Mm-hmm. And in a way, that Cambridge catalog still reflects that idea of the book that a scholar has personalized. Mm-hmm. But the range of these images, there's no decorum to them at all. Thomas Smith, in his copy of Plato, which is in Lambeth Palace, has this wonderful picture by In the Republic of a very depressed poet with laurel leaves leaving the city. But in his Josephus, every time Josephus mentions circumcision, there's a little penis in the margin.
Yes.
Of course.
Absolutely. Jeff up here.
So thinking about the history of reading and the history of myths of reading, Roland Barthes and his accounts of how regularly we betray the notion that reading is a serial left to right and down the page process. Mm. So I'm wondering what you see of the varieties of attention and inattention in these texts, if there's a variety of kind of poetics of interactions, and particularly in relation to a category that I know is dear to the distractible heart of Cabinet, which is doodling.
I'm surprised I didn't. I'm not sure I used any puns. That must be a first. But I've talked in the newer work on drawing and reading about drawing attention to things. And that is really the function, I think, of the manicule in particular. There's a interesting thing that we've all become, I think, aware of is, you know, how long it takes to do something. Why would somebody, that was the question I first asked, why would you bother? It's actually not a very precise pointer. You could underline with more precision and more speed. But so why would you take the time to draw an entire hand, sometimes a cuff, sometimes jewelry? You know, why would you do that? And there is something going on about, but I do, you stole one of my lines. I ask, is this, are doodles signs of attention or inattention? And I think it's an open question in a lot of cases. But in a lot of examples, I'm absolutely persuaded that what looks like inattention is the opposite.
One function, I think, is mnemonic.
Indeed.
And again, you know, this is, yeah. And one of the ways in which this apparently rather chaotic way of dealing with the text may actually be the foundation on which you get, my friend David Quint would always say, this is not the place to look for really good readings. The place to look for a good reading of Virgil is in Milton. The place to look for, you know, a good, or in Tasso. And it may be that this is how you build the text into yourself. And then, in a way that you don't see in margins or in the classroom, you can, as poet to poet, respond to the whole arc of a text, see things that are never part of the education and that never get written down. So that this could be a not sufficient, but a necessary part of that deeper kind of reading.
And, of course, how do you read silence in the margins? Because, again, that question, you think, okay, I want, it's a great copy of Moore's Utopia at the Huntington that I looked at. And book one, which is the book that nobody is really interested in because it's not the playful utopian bit, is heavily annotated. You know, everything is marked in the margins. Book two, the fictional utopian bit, where we would love to have a contemporary reader's response, utter silence, nothing. Did they stop reading or did they really start reading? Who knows?
And, of course, Utopia is equipped from the second Basel edition on with these idiotic notes by Erasmus saying, laugh here, you know, basically, isn't this cool? And I've always wondered what the intention of those was. The other thing I'd want to emphasize is this prior reckoning that we find in so many books that belong to somebody like Harvey or Casaubon, where the writer actually says, this is the scopus, this is the point of this text, or this is the scopus of my reading, not always assuming that it's the only point of the text. Right. There is a kind of explicitness and precision about that which really makes sense in a world in which you have religious wars over the meaning of hoc est corpus meum. So again, that's a way of focusing attention to go through a text in a very particular way and can be really wonderful. As when Casaubon's reading Isaiah in Hebrew, he says, you know, so this is a law case here and we're talking about pleading. So we're going to read this in terms of the rhetoric of pleading. And he has this magnificent kind of commentary in a manuscript. So that method can actually yield the most extraordinary kinds of close reading results.
One more question.
There's one right here.
Right here.
I noticed that a lot of my friends who smoke and read at the same time. There was a beautiful book a few years ago, Cigarettes Are Sublime.
Mm-hmm.
The idea was that every cigarette was a thought. And maybe every doodle was a thought. It was a moment to stop and think.
Yeah.
And I remember Leo Steinberg told me before he died, his favorite moment was when he left the picture gallery and had his cigarette. Because that's when he did his thinking.
Perfect final comment, I think, for those of you who are desperate or whose bladders are approaching the state of Casaubon. Thank you for your patience. That was tremendous.
And thank you all for those wonderful questions.